So I thought a lot about what to speak. I wanted to do something a little different than last evening. Well, last evening was nice. And tomorrow was also going to be a different nice. So we're going to be discussing some verses from Srimad Bhagavatam. And those that attended the class this morning, it's a continuation on to the next set of verses. And for those of you that weren't attending the class this morning, a little background. The chapter is 21, Canto 3, title of its Conversations Between Manu and Kardama. And we didn't get there yet. It's now conversation between Lord Vishnu and Kardama. Who is Kardama? Kardama Muni. Kardama Muni is one of the direct sons of Lord Brahma. In sequence, Brahma is born from the lotus flower of Garbhadakshe Vishnu, first born of Lord Brahma, the four Kumaras, following the four Kumaras, Lord Shiva. Following Lord Shiva, there are the 10 great sages, one of whom is number 11 out of the 10. That's how it works. And his name is Kardama. And each of these great sages, they're born from different parts of the body, from the arms, from the legs, from the head, from the limbs of... And Kardama is born from the shadow of Brahma, and Narada is one of those 10. So he's Narada's brother. And all of them, except Narada, have a particular function. They're just as was requested of the four Kumaras, who said, "No thanks, Dad." The others are Prajapatis. So a question 2 chapters ago, or beginning of chapter 20, what did Brahma do to help fill this now hollow universe that has now some planets and some places, but it needs population? What did the Prajapatis do, the sons of Brahma, do to help bring about the sub-creation existence as we know it? Or at least as it began. And so this is, the time is the very, very, very beginning of Satya Yuga. And it can be taken, it's the beginning of a day of Brahma. It can be taken, it's the beginning of the life of Brahma, because the same pattern repeats itself. Time is cyclical and the same sequence of events take place. So it's Satya Yuga. And the age of, in Satya Yuga, the means of achieving spiritual perfection is through dhyan, or through meditation. And Prabhupada makes it very, very clear in several verses, it's not minus bhakti, there's a particular concentration and meditation upon the personality of Godhead. But in order to fix one's meditation upon the personality of God, the other processes are also there, hearing and chanting. It doesn't describe how he did hearing and chanting off in the forest, but it indicates that devotional practices and principles were there. And Maitreya became perfect. Not Maitreya, Kardama became perfect. And in that stage of perfection, Lord Vishnu is very pleased, very much like Dhruva Maharaj. Lord Vishnu came. And as he came before Dhruva on the back of Garuda, only in the case of Dhruva, he stood before Dhruva. In this case, he's flying in the air, standing on the back of Garuda, who's flapping his wings. smiling, looking in all directions with a very pleasing, glowing glance and features, and Kardama is stunned, jubilant, in ecstasy. He heard he speaks of the Lord as the reservoir of all goodness and all pleasure. So he's feeling, we discussed this morning, the experience of Vishuddha Sattva, not just, like we know that the happiness of goodness, a little bit. When, for example, when we purposefully go out of our way, trying in a humble mood to do something that's of benefit for others, and there's a happiness in doing that. Yes? We all know. So, but there is also a mix, that the other modes of nature are also there. And Vishuddha Sattva is the nature of the spiritual world. In the Vishuddha Sattva, there's no mix. It's unmixed goodness. And Kardama is in the presence of he who is the source of all unmixed goodness. So he's feeling great happiness, transcendental happiness, unbounded transcendental happiness. And he's saying, this is the perfection. To see your form is the perfection. Meditate upon the form is the process, and seeing the form and experience that happiness of his loving relationship with the Lord is the stage of perfection. Now I'm going to read two, maybe three verses, and these verses very much remind one, if you listen carefully, they remind you of verses from Bhagavad Gita. So what's the relationship between Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam? Prabhupada gives the comparison. It's like lower mathematics and higher mathematics, and lower mathematics 2 plus 2 equals 4, and higher mathematics 2 plus 2 equals 4. Nothing changes, but the application of 2 plus 2 equals 4 can be far more sophisticated kinds of application. So the same, the teachings don't change, but in the Bhagavatam, the personality of Godhead in his unalloyed goodness is being clearly indicated, as the teaching of Bhagavad Gita says. That's the attainment that is desired by the Vedic process. Krishna says that in very early in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2. Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nish Trigunya Bhavarjana. The Vedas deal mainly with the modes of material nature, and specifically being an enjoyer within the modes of material nature. And then Krishna's advice is Nish Trigunya. Rise above all the modes of material nature, Arjuna. Be transcendental to all of them. Of course, you need a process for that. You need to be connected to that which is beyond them. And so the Bhagavatam is now, here it is. Here's what it looks like. And listen to Kardama, and here's what it feels like. So we're given the, through, I was describing this to a group of Western people that didn't know what things mean. So it's helpful to bring things to that level. Purana means ancient history. So it's not fiction, it's history. These are historical events. But they illustrate lessons of life or teachings that we should live by. And so not only it's nice story, it's easy to listen to the nice story, but it tells you, or demonstrates, this is... So the Bhagavad Gita just gives the teaching, and that's nice. But so what does it look like? And then it's Bhagavatam. So in the first verse, Kardama doesn't identify that he's in the category of an attached person. He speaks of even attached persons should worship you. And the next verse is he describes himself as an attached person, which seems a little unusual because there he is face to face with the Supreme Lord. So how could he be, you know, an attached person? And it's one of these, well, it depends on how you look at it, situations. you know, is it a wave or is it a particle? Those of you that know science, you know what I'm talking about. And, you know, so from the point of, from the angle of perception, you can see this or you can see that. A little bit like the discussion last night about, is it a principle or is it a detail? So, in any case, karma is identifying the munificence, the merciful nature of the personality of Godhead, and how he bestows his benediction upon all, and even those who want something material, he bestows his benediction upon such people. So here's the verse. Text 14 from chapter 21. Your lotus feet are the true vessel to take one across the ocean of material nescience. Only persons deprived of their intelligence by the spell of the deluding energy will worship those feet with a view to attain the trivial and momentary pleasures of the senses, while even persons rotting in hell, which even persons rotting in hell can attain. However, O my Lord, you are so kind that you bestow mercy even upon them. Now, hearing that translation, do you think of other verses from Srimad Bhagavatam that speak a similar message? What about the words of Dhruva Maharaj upon seeing the personality of Godhead? What did Dhruva say? I was desiring something very poor and paltry, like a piece of broken glass. Instead, I've gotten you that's like a valuable jewel. And he was lamenting. How foolish. I was embarrassed. How foolish. Because he got that which was his object of meditation. He got the kingdom. It was this little boy in this, you know, feisty, chivalrous mood. I want a kingdom. And he didn't want just a kingdom. He wanted a kingdom better than his father, better than his father's father, and better than his father's father's father, who is Vishnu. Excuse me, Brahma. His father was Uttanapada. His father's father was Swayambhuva Manu. His father's father's father was Lord Brahma. So what's better than that? It's the kingdom of God. So here's a little boy saying, I want to rule the kingdom of God. And he achieved such a destination. So you better watch out what you desire. Now he became relieved of the desire, but he got the kingdom. And when Lord Vishnu left, he cried. He was very happy. He saw the Supreme Lord. But he was so unhappy. How foolish. Because I could have gone with him. But instead I have to stay here. And for 60,000 years rule on earth and then go to Dhruvaloka. How unfortunate. And he cried and he cried. He's a little boy. He just cried like little boys cry. He cried and he cried and he cried and he cried. And then when he finished crying, what was he going to do but go back to his father's kingdom? That was the order of Lord Vishnu. Any other messages that you can think of from the Bhagavatam that illustrate this? Second canto verse. Akarma sarvakamova mokshakama udaradi. How's it end? Tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. It's in the verse, it said, as this verse is saying, only foolish people want something temporary. There's a whole series of verses. Some will want this, They want good health, they worship the sun god. Some will want wealth, they worship Kuvera. Those who want this, they worship this person. They want that, they worship that person. But those that are wise, those that are intelligent, they worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then it says, it doesn't matter if you have material desire, no material desire, or desire liberation. Worship the Personality of Godhead. But not just worship, Tivra Bhakti, very, very strong devotional service. Because he's the source of everything. Material benediction, spiritual benediction, liberation. There's another place that very similar to what's being written here. It's nice to appreciate the messages of the Bhagavatam and the symmetry of the messages of the Bhagavatam and even how they're laid out, how they're unfolded. So the teachings of Rishabhdev in his discussion with his 100 sons. It's like the very beginning of his teaching, and it's such a fundamental teaching that during the days when Prabhupada established Gurukuls, he had the teachers have the boys chant the verses of Rishabhdev every day in the morning before they began their classes. And those of you that have been to Vrindavan, you know where the Gurukula area for years and years was, that oval place, and there's three floors of classrooms. So the kids would stand on the balcony, you know, like 100 of them, in the top of their loud, high-pitched voices, chant these verses, and the whole place would shaking. And the teaching to the sons of Rishabhdev that they shouldn't waste their time with those pleasures that are easily available even to hogs and dogs. The pleasure of the senses is not meant for the human form of life, but tapo devyam putraka yena shud yed satvam, the means that will purify your existence, divine austerity, tapo devyam, that's what the human form of life is meant for. And with that divine austerity, then one becomes eligible for higher thought and receiving higher mercy, not just get something of this world, something temporary and, as he's saying, momentary pleasures of the senses. But there are those that have an attraction for the momentary pleasure of the senses, and Krishna is so kind that he's even merciful upon those persons. Just put this in the context of ISKCON for a moment. Common within our sampradaya is a standard that Prabhupada also followed, that first initiation was more liberal. It's even much more liberal in some of the Gaudiya circles. But for us, 16 rounds and 4 regular principles, minimum for some period of time, minimum. And then first initiation. And Prabhupada considered that as formal connection with him and the disciplic succession. And the second initiation was given far more conservatively by Srila Prabhupada. I could tell some stories, but he considered it far more significant. I'll tell one story. The first initiation that I participated in New York, it was, devotees came, Prabhupada came from Europe, landed in New York, and devotees came from all over, like South America, West Coast, Canada, Timbuktu, everybody came. So the house was packed. It was a big, large structure. It held a lot of people. And there were initiations every day for like a week. And 20, 25 devotees were initiated each day. And he did it like each day. And it was really nice. He chanted the japa because he personally chanted on her beads in front of everybody. Later on it was another system. He had some assistants chant on the beads, and then here's your duly initiated beads and here's your name. other people chanted on the beads. But right in front of us, he would hang the beads on the, or the servant would hang the beads on the microphone stand. One by one, when he'd take the mic, the beads off, and right in front of us, chant on the beads. And we were chanting along with Prabhupada. And I can tell you that he chanted very quickly. I mean, much more quickly than I chant. But it was audible. He was chanting, the microphone was by him, and we could hear him chanting, and he was chanting every syllable. And then, you know, put the beads back, and then the next set of beads. And so, at some point, there were some second initiations. And the president of the San Diego temple had 6 or 8 devotees that he was recommending for a second initiation. And it was Gunagrai Maharaj at the time, not Maharaj. So Gunagrai Das Adhikari. So Prabhupada called him into his quarters. He was very pleased to be called into Prabhupada's quarters. And Prabhupada asked him, are you sure about these 8 or 6 or these recommendations? Are they fixed and firm in their practices? And he said, yes, Prabhupada, I'm very sure. Some time passed and Prabhupada called him in again. Are you sure that you're sure? And he said, well, I'll double check, Prabhupada. I'll ask the other senior devotees and I'll make sure every last one, you know, and I'll get, so he got back, yes, everyone. And Prabhupada called him a third time. Are you sure that you're sure that you're sure? In other words, Prabhupada was indicating, teaching by his example, he considered second initiation to be a very, very serious commitment or prior qualification necessary before brahminical initiation. So brahminical initiation means, or it includes, receiving Gayatri Mantra. Now I'm going to go a little bit for just a quick moment to Sri Brahma Samhita, where the Gayatri Mantra, well, we hear that from the Bhagavatam that Lord Brahma, when he was born, he had to understand what he was to do and who he was and where he came from and what's his duty. And being intelligent, he saw he was seated on a lotus and he kind of intuitively reasoned, well, if I find where this lotus comes from, then I'll find where I come from. So he climbed down the stem of the lotus, and he climbed down and 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 he climbed down and he couldn't find the end to the lotus. And he realized, I'm not going to find out who I am that way, by sense perception or by reason. That's what we're to understand from that. And then he heard the syllables. Ta-pa, ta-pa, ta-pa. We hear that in the Bhagavatam. What we hear in Sri Brahma Samhita is in addition, so he went back up and he performed ta-pa. But somewhere on his way back up, according to Sri Brahma Samhita, he heard Saraswati. Now, this is before there's a universe filled up. So it's not the goddess of learning Saraswati, not that one. This is before that one. This is the internal potency, or in Bhaktisiddhanta's language, the prototype, Saraswati, or the internal potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Earlier, she's referred to as Rama, just as there's Lakshmi, Narayan, or Sitaram, Radha Krishna. There's Rama, Vishnu. So then Garbhadakshay Vishnu, also Rama, or in this case Saraswati, meaning the internal potency, was the initiator of Lord Brahma. Very fortunate, huh? And she spoke with him, she spoke to him in the following way, my dear Lord Brahma, please receive this mantra, and the mantra was then given, and by it, it will fulfill all your desire, which is very nice unless you have some material desire. And if you get material desires fulfilled, you become entangled, right? So what to do? So now, he then, after chanting that mantra for 1,000 celestial years, which is a long time, he then heard the sound of Krishna's flute that came out of his mouth in the form of another Gayatri mantra. And then he chanted that Gayatri mantra, and he came to realize his identity in his spiritual form. Just from mantra chanting, just from chanting Gayatri. Then he spoke the prayers, the Govinda Stotra prayers. And then, it's not over yet, he realizes, I still have a material desire. Because way back over here where Saraswati said, by chanting of this mantra, it will fulfill, all your desires will be fulfilled. So he had some spiritual desire, but he also had a material desire. His material desire was to create a universe. And we're going to hear next where Kardva Muni is going to speak what his material desire was. And it was fulfilled. But it was fulfilled in service to the personality of Godhead, specifically so the personality of Godhead could become his son. That's a pretty spiritual desire. But for that he needed a wife, and that's in the next verse. And he's likening himself to a materialist that has a desire to have a wife, so that he could have a family. Normally that's a material desire. In Kardva Muni's sake, because he did his practice so proficiently, you know, the language that Bhaktisiddhanta uses is dovetail. We've all heard that term, dovetail. Like, you know, commonly, kids, our youth, they like music. So they dovetail their liking for music, so they do kirtan. They may not like to do anything else in devotional service, but they like kirtan. And it's not this place in particular or any place in particular. It's just, you know, it's a dovetail. They like music, and then there's music, and so they play music in Krishna consciousness. Don't ask them to, you know, cut the vegetable or clean the floor or take out the garbage or, you know, that kirtan, fine. They like, it's a dovetail. Not so much for Krishna. It's, you know, it's, they like music. There's a much higher standard where Kardama is exhibiting, and for that matter, Dhruva is exhibiting. He wanted a kingdom, then the desire to rule the kingdom was gone, but now he had to rule the kingdom because the Lord gave him that service. So here Kardama has this desire to have a family where one of his children is the personality of Godhead. And like, he had the qualification for it too. It wasn't like a, you know, pipe dream. So I'm going to read a little bit. When we receive Gayatri initiation, it's very important, as with Brahma, that we understand the mantra that we chant when chanting Gayatri mantra can also fulfill material desire. So it's very important, as Prabhupada was being very particular about the candidates for second initiation, that they have directionally, at least, strong, fixed material, a spiritual desire. Fixed. Because otherwise, the material desires will be end up getting fulfilled instead of the spiritual desires. It's important that that those that are that receive initiation, particularly Brahminical initiation, but for that matter initiation, that we represent what the teachings say. We cultivate in our life what the teachings say. And, you know, look at the statistics. How many people receive initiation, and how many people many years later are still performing devotional service with that same vigor and strength as the day that they received initiation? And it's not a very high percentage. So it's important individually and societally, collectively, that we value that which we're being given at the time of receiving mercy from our spiritual masters and connect with that higher purpose. Very important. So here's the purport. Prabhupada's writing about Karda Muni's first verse here for this evening. As stated in Bhagavad Gita's 7th chapter, there are two kinds of devotees. Those who desire material pleasures and those who desire nothing but service to the Lord. Material pleasures can be attained even by hogs and dogs. That's Rishabdev. Whose condition of life is hellish. The hog also eats, sleeps, and enjoys sex life to the full extent, and it is also very satisfied with such hellish enjoyment of material existence. Modern yogis advise that because one has senses, one must enjoy to the fullest extent, like cats and dogs. Yet one can go on and practice yoga. This is condemned here by Kardama Muni. He says that such material pleasures are available for cats and dogs in a hellish condition. The Lord is so kind that if so-called yogis are satisfied by hellish pleasures, he can give them facility to attain all material pleasures they desire. But they cannot attain the perfectional stage attained by Kardama Muni. So our attention needs to be directed to the Vishuddha stage. We may not be there, but it should be directed there. This is the message of the Bhagavatam. Yes, it's verse after verse and purport after purport directing us to the ultimate position. In case we're not clear, it says it again and again and from so many different angles. So it's really in focus, sharp focus. Paragraph. Hellish and demoniac persons do not actually know what is the ultimate attainment in perfection, and therefore they think that sense gratification is the highest goal of life. They advise that one can satisfy the senses and at the same time, by reciting some mantra and by some practice, can cheaply aspire for perfection. Such persons are described here as hatha medhasa, which means, quote, those whose brains are spoiled. They aspire for material enjoyment by perfection of yoga or meditation. In Bhagavad Gita, it is stated by the Lord that the intelligence of those who worship the demigods has been spoiled. Similarly here too, it is stated by Kardama Muni that one who aspires after material enjoyment by practice of yoga has spoiled his brain substance and his full number one. Prabhupada is not gentle when it comes to telling black from white. Very clear. The Lord is kind, however, that even today, persons whose brain substance is spoiled are given the benediction to become cats, dogs, or hogs, and enjoy material happiness from sex life and sense gratification. The Lord confirms this benediction in Bhagavad Gita. Quote, whatever a person aspires to receive from me, I offer him as he desires. Yayatam mam prapadyante. So next verse. It sounds like he's distancing himself from such a mentality, but the next verse says, I have that mentality, and you're still being kind to me. Text 15. Therefore, desiring to marry a girl of like disposition, who may prove to be a veritable cow of plenty in my married life to satisfy my lustful desire, I too have sought the shelter of your lotus feet, which are the source of everything, for you are like a desire tree. If you just read the previous verse and don't read this verse, sounds like I'm not over there, and then it's I'm over there. I am such a foolish person. Purport. In spite of his condemning persons who approach the Lord for material advantages, Kardama Muni expressed his material inability and desire before the Lord by saying, quote, although I know that nothing material should be asked from you, I nevertheless desire to marry a girl of like disposition. The phrase, quote, like disposition, is very significant. Formerly, boys and girls of similar dispositions were married. The similar natures of the boy and girl were united in order to make them happy. Not more than 25 years ago, and perhaps it is still current, parents in India used to consult the horoscope of the boy and girl to see whether there would be factual union in their psychological conditions. These considerations are very important. Nowadays, marriage takes place without such consultation, and therefore, soon after the marriage, there's divorce and separation. Formerly, husband and wife used to live together peacefully throughout their whole lives, but nowadays, it is a very difficult task. Paragraph. I hear some chuckles. Kardama Muni wanted to have a wife of like disposition because a wife is necessary to assist in spiritual and material advancement. It is said that a wife yields the fulfillment of all desires in religion, economic development, and sense gratification. If one has a nice wife, he is to be considered a most fortunate man. In astrology, a man is considered fortunate who has great wealth, very good sons, and a good wife, and a very good wife. Of these three, one who has a very good wife is considered the most fortunate. Before marrying, one should select a wife of like disposition and not be enamored by so-called beauty or other attractive features for sense gratification. In the Bhagavatam, 12th canto, it is said that in Kali Yuga marriage will be based on the consideration of sex life. As soon as there is deficiency in sex life, the question of divorce will arise. And last paragraph. Kardama Muni could have asked his benediction from Uma, for it is recommended in the scriptures that if anyone wants a good wife, he should worship Uma. But he preferred to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead because it is recommended in the Bhagavatam that everyone, whether he is full of desires, has no desire, or desires liberation, should worship the Supreme Lord. Of these three classes of men, one who tries to be happy by fulfillment of material desires, another wants to be happy by becoming one with the Supreme, and another, the perfect man, is a devotee. He does not want anything in return from the Personality of Godhead. He only wants to render transcendental living service. In any case, everyone should worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead, for he will fulfill everyone's desire. The advantage of worshiping the Supreme Person is that even if one has desires for material enjoyment, if he worships Krishna, he will gradually become a pure devotee, like Dhruva became, and have no more material hankering. There's a verse in the fifth canto that says, there's no one that's a better worshipable Lord than the Personality of Godhead, because he's so kind that if people approach him for something material, he doesn't give them something material, thinking that something material will simply entangle them in complexity. But if he does give them something material, it's with the understanding that I'm not going to be so foolish. I'm not going to give them something material, but I'll give them my two lotus feet. And then when they have that something material, they won't desire the enjoyment of that material thing. There's no better Lord than the Supreme Master, than the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that's one of the explanations of why it's vastly recommended or superior to worship the Personality of Godhead as opposed to the demigods. Because whatever the demigods can provide, Personality of Godhead is the source of that which they provide, but he does it in such a way that the hankering for those things is taken away, is dissipated. Now let's get back to this position, because it seems a little bit like a contradiction. But here's Kardama, and he has this desire. Or like with Lord Brahma, he had a desire, and he still saw the personality of Godhead. So there's a question. One question is, how does that happen? And one answer is, in the case of Lord Brahma, his desire wasn't separate from the Lord; it was in relation to the Lord. In fact, the Srishti Shakti, the desire, the potency to create, was invested in him by the personality of Godhead directly. Much like the capacity that anybody has to do anything comes from the personality of Godhead. Our ability to get up and walk across the floor, which could be taken away from us, the ability comes from the same place. So how do we use that walking ability to go to the temple? According to the Bhagavatam, those legs which do not go to places of pilgrimage are no better than tree trunks. And our ability to see, which also can be taken away from us. What's the use of the eyes? They're no better than the plumes on a peacock if one doesn't see the forms of the Lord. This is the second canto. So our ability to do anything comes from the Supreme Lord. And the desire to do something, of course, it's largely it's from our contact, past contact with the modes of nature. And so we have desires. So to align those desires with the personality of Godhead's desire, that's the dovetail notion. And after all of his realization described in the Govinda prayers, Lord Brahma turns to Krishna, who he heard the second Gayatri mantra that he received from, and says, I have a dilemma. I have this nice I'm paraphrasing, of course. I have this nice realization of spiritual reality, but I have this other thing here, that's this material desire. And I'm very concerned if I act according to this material desire, I may forget you. But what to do, because I have this material desire? And the answer that's given is, when, again, I'm simplifying it, but it's called Gona Bhakti, or Gona Dharma, Gona, that which is dealing with material nature or the modes of material nature. If one does those activities for the satisfaction of the personality of Godhead, and at the same time joins those activities with the regulations of bhakti, then those activities can be as purifying as the regulations of bhakti. It's something like, saying it in different language, it's something like karma yoga, like yad karoshi, yad asnasi, yad dahosi, dadasi, yad. Whatever you do, do it for Krishna. But that's not complete, because there's further purification needed. Chapter 12, Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna speaks, the topmost stage is absorption in thought of him with intelligence fully engaged in his service. In such a state, one lives in him always. And then he says, if you can't do that, follow the regulations of bhakti yoga and you'll develop the desire to attain to that stage. If you find difficulty following the regulations of bhakti yoga, then try to work for me. So this is the answer given, which applies also to here in the Kardama Muni section here. Engage the propensities that you have in such a way that it's meant for Krishna's pleasure. And side by side, so it's the work for Krishna, it's the karma yoga aspect, but then follow the regulations of bhakti. It strengthens or spiritualizes the working for Krishna part. So it also becomes as purifying as the regulations of bhakti. We don't have the capacity to simply hear and chant. It would be nice if we did, but we don't. Recognizing that we don't, Prabhupada gave the prescription. Certain minimum regulation, and that should be done without fail, minimum regulation of devotional activity, and side by side working. I've just received for Krishna. I had some discussion with somebody in the course of my travels and just wrote following up that discussion. They're doing lots of hearing and chanting, but they're not finding that they're making spiritual advancement. And they don't know exactly why. And then, so in the discussion, I said, I don't know you, but I must say, you've been doing these hearing and chanting and reading and studying, hearing Prabhupada's lectures for some 7 years. Of doing it very steadily and chanting. So there's some taste there. You can't say that you're not making any advancement. There's something that's keeping you going, but there's also something that's holding you back. And the thing that's holding him back appears is his something that he developed very nicely in his childhood and who knows for how many lifetimes. His career advancement thing is like big time, and you know it takes a lot of time, and it's like progressing in his career and studies, and it's not even so much, you know, it's not money, it's just, you know, it's work to the exclusion of, you know, for what its purpose is the work to be applied. Working for Krishna. And if you're not working for Krishna, what are you working for? Either directly in a gross sense gratification, or the subtle sense of accomplishment and mastering something. Just different varieties of the mode of passion that then obscures Krishna. And largely that's the society that we're living within. It's a society of passion. Lots of fruitive activity. And to be successful, you have to be really good at the game. The fruitive activity game. I was thinking, as we were leaving, then coming over here, that the place where we live, where Rama lives. So, it's Little India. But, you know, I was thinking specifically... This isn't what it looked like in India. You know, the nice little brick houses all in a row, and they all have their nice little driveways with the two cars in the driveways and the kids playing. You know, it looks different in India. But, you know, it says these are people that are, you know, they know how to play the game better or something. They have the facilities. And, you know, then the middle class Indian population is also growing, and they can make their own little living situations that look like however they want it to look like. And then coming over here, you know, well, there's some more Americans and some other people, but there's a lot of Indians over here too. And so it's not just what's the goal. And then amongst those Indians, how rare is it that persons can capture the essence of bhakti, the real purpose as bhakti. You know, so once one has those assets of the fruits of your activity, does it bring satisfaction? Is it really that was the goal and now we got it? We're in heaven or something? Doesn't look like it. And then even so, to me it looks like sense gratification. You know, but it's... Then even within devotee communities, I don't know how things are going well in Detroit community, but I hear that the divorce rate is not small in ISKCON, and even in the Indian community, the divorce rate amongst devotee Indian community is not as small as you think it would be, should be, could be. So there's need to, like, do the things that we do with the higher principle in mind. That's what I'm trying to communicate here through. That's what Prabhupada is saying in the purports. And what Kardamuni is saying also. But the purpose of our involving ourselves in things of this world when we're trying to cultivate Krishna consciousness is they may be necessary for us for a... to be peaceful, to go forward on a progressive path of life, spiritual life. So then we need to be very clear that this is for Krishna. It's not for sense gratification. It's for Krishna. It's not for sense gratification. There may be some necessity, like, let's say, eating. It's for Krishna. It's for the language of Prabhupada, maintaining body and soul together. And so we like to eat, and we like to make nice things and offer nice things. But the bhakti dimension needs to be what we're cultivating, not just, you know, varieties and tastes and likings and so forth. To have our life progressive, it's that they work for the satisfaction of Krishna. And in one sense it's a fine line, and the other sense is like the difference between day and night. It's the difference between elevation and degradation, going up and going down. Again, the same pleasures that are available for hogs and dogs and camels and asses and cats and dogs and monkeys, and those same pleasures are available. This is the Bhagavatam's message. We shouldn't pursue them. Rishabhdev is telling his 100 sons. Many of them became kings. They became married. They had children. But the purpose of that, becoming a king, getting married, having children, whether you're a king or whatever else you might be, it shouldn't be for that purpose. And the Bhagavatam's message is that right from Canto 1. Dharmasya hi apavargasya narto tayopakalpate. The purpose of dharma is not artha and then kama. So, you know, do it for sense gratification. Never should be done for that purpose. The righteous life is not for that purpose, although commonly that's how people think. Rather, it's for ultimate liberation. And when something does come, because you've done your dharma nicely, you should never be deployed for sense gratification. Anyway, you've heard these things. I'm just repeating them. But it's important that we capture the essence. And the reason that's repeated over and over and over in the Bhagavatam and in Prabhupada's purports is because it's so important. And also because we don't get it. Like, we go, yeah, 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 and then we don't get it. We keep, you know, like the donkey program. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We just keep going. And then some misery, and we don't like the misery, and so, like, you know, sit straight for a while, and then becomes... It's... For those who wish progressive life, the messages of the Bhagavatam should be heard very carefully, because that's what it's meant to take us to Krishna and out of this cycle of foolishness that doesn't bring happiness, although we think it's meant to bring us happiness. It brings bondage. Take the high road. Go to Krishna. The Bhagavatam will take us there. Okay, so any comments or discussion? Hare Krishna.
Thank you for the class. Maharaj, you said that finally you were pointing out that as you give the example of that person that who was not doing his karma for Krishna, so you said that we should be doing whatever work we do for Krishna,
yeah,
and then aligning them with the principles of bhakti.
Yes.
So, however, I am presently a student. I find it very difficult to balance two things. I'm always like either doing one thing properly or the other thing. So like devotees ask me to do my studies properly, but at the same time when I do it, try to do it properly, I don't feel that I'm associating with the devotees properly. So I want to get more association, more hearing, more chanting. When I do that properly, I feel the anxiety that I'm not doing my responsibilities properly. So is that state of imbalance? How can that imbalance be removed?
Okay. Well, I have a transcendental solution. It's not a question of balance at all. It's a question of for whom you do it. And I'll explain. Balance indicates there's like a pan scale. And there's, you know, put something here, and then put something here, and that's the balance. So if everything is done for Krishna, then there's no question of balance. It reveals the, you know, the dilemma. It's a false dilemma. So we're enjoined to do certain things. So you do those things, and you do them for Krishna, and you do those things, you do them for Krishna, you do those. The question of balance is removed if you do what you do for Krishna, including starting with sadhana. Do it to bring you closer to Krishna. You do that nicely, and the balance question just evaporates. Yeah, but. Okay. Yes.
Hare Krishna. Maharaj, like at least from my own personal experience, I was realizing or seeing that that when I have some problems or I'm not in a good situation, I have anxiety for the situation to become better.
Can you hear him in the back?
Just a little.
Sometimes I'm in anxiety. A little.
When situations are not good.
When situations are not good.
I'm in anxiety that the situation should become better.
Yeah.
And
you're right. Situation should become better.
And when situations are good and Krishna provides everything, then
I become complacent.
I'm in anxiety that. When will the situation go away? Then I'm also in anxiety that Krishna has provided me this wonderful situation and opportunity, and I'm not doing enough to do service for him and not enough to serve him. I mean, and one angle the situation is, oh, when will the situation go away? And sometimes when I try to think about what Krishna has done, everything, the anxiety goes away, but from time to time it keeps coming back. So, I would like to know that.
The solution is Krishna consciousness. Anyone else? Remember, last night I was describing what I think. Ours is the service department, Krishna is the controlling department. Did I discuss that last night?
Yes, this morning.
This morning? Okay. So, the anxiety comes when, you know, one wants to be the controller of the circumstances, and you're not. So naturally it's anxiety because you're not. And, you know, and so now recognizing that you're not, what am I? I'm the servant. And the nature of, you know, the world of duality in which I live is sometimes it's this, sometimes it's that. That's the nature of duality. Sometimes it's light and sometimes it's dark. Sometimes it's hot, sometimes it's cold. Sometimes things are going well, sometimes things are not going well. What's my position? I'm the servant. This is as this variety of service to Krishna and that variety of service to Krishna. It's not like riding in a vehicle when there's nobody sitting in the driver's seat. Krishna's in the driver's seat. And he can have me sit in the passenger seat or the back seat or in the trunk or wherever he wants. my trust goes to Krishna, and I'm his servant, and he's engaging me in his service. And if my deserve is this, then it's this, and if it's that, then it's that. And like I was, you know, it's a circumstance beyond our control. We made choices back there somewhere that says it's sometimes going to be like, and so here we are. The fruits of my past deeds are going to come. What's now? So that's out of my control. Now what's in my control? The position of service, my free will. How I choose to serve, and the choice to serve, to be in the mood of service, and then with the intelligence that Krishna gives me to do my best to serve. So stay in your rightful position, the servant of Krishna. Now, that doesn't mean your intelligence goes to sleep. You use it for the best means of serving Krishna. But it's the intelligence will be misused, and the mind will give one unlimited amounts of grief if the position of being the servant is forgotten or eclipsed. Like you said, I do a little reset and think, you know, something. And so I just have to accept this is the arrangement. And I'm just going to use whatever. Then I lose that and I get an anxiety again. But just stay in the... So the solution is Krishna consciousness. And it all starts, you know, Krishna consciousness starts in your bead bag. It's my little slogan. Krishna consciousness starts in your bead bag. How you chant your rounds every day. What's your relationship with Krishna? Through the medium of chanting of the holy name. It's a relationship with the holy name, which tells your relationship with Krishna, which tells how you live your life. As circumstances, as the world of duality keeps changing out there, how are you going to direct yourself to that? From the position of being the servant of Krishna. That's awakened most effectively through the chanting of Krishna's holy name. And then comes, like, you know, then there's the association of devotees, and there's other things that we do that will certainly help us. Our hearing and chanting and praying and so forth, the other processes of bhakti. But the most important is then your disposition or your regard for circumstances that are beyond your control. You use your intelligence to direct your service in a proper way. You make a plan, but you're ready for if a different plan, if that's Krishna's different plan. We use our intelligence in Krishna's service, not to be the position of the controller. He's the controller, we're the servant. Tadami buddhiyogam tam yena mam upiyanti te. And that Tesham Satati Yuktana. Something? Yes?
Well, it's like, you know, here, you know, we saw like how like Lord Brahma and Kardamuni, you know, they acknowledged their material desire and then they expressed it to Lord, you know, and used it in his service. So, like, for me, you know, like, accepting my material desire or even my family's, like, dependent material desire, it becomes hard and, you know, it creates, like, anger and anxiety. So, like, how can, like, come out of it, you know, like, accept our material desire, but at the same time...
I think I know what you're saying, but I'm not. My hesitation is I'm not completely sure. So let me begin answering. If I'm off target, you let me know. It's not. So something that you are able to acknowledge is you or members of your family may have material desire. That's not the problem. I recognize that there are material desires, and here's some of them, and there's probably a bunch more than some of them. So that's not the problem, is identifying what's the spiritual and what's a material desire. It's how you handle that situation. So what's something that's the two somethings that's necessary is what we're hearing here, taking shelter of Krishna. So there's message of taking shelter of the demigods. That's theistic. An atheistic is, I don't take shelter of anybody. That's a fruitive worker. That's not theistic. Then the fruitive worker, that's theistic, and then there's a devotee. So acknowledgement of Krishna is one important factor. And then a second important factor, that how to best address this, is as a aspiring, shelter-taking individual in Krishna, here's what the goal looks like. Now, I already did the first part. I know that there's material desires over here. I've taken shelter of Krishna. I know what the goal looks like. Now there's these material desires down here. Now what do I do? It's take a step towards Krishna. And take a doable step. Some of you can sustain. And one of the recommendations sequentially in Bhagavad Gita is from this 12th chapter, work for Krishna. There's something that's below that one too, but let's just start with that one. Work for Krishna. This is the sarva kama, but with tivra bhakti, and that's what Dhruva did. He had a big time material desire. He was just a kid, but he pursued shelter in Vishnu for the purpose of fulfilling the material desire, because he knew it was beyond his capacity, but it was not beyond the capacity of Vishnu to fulfill that desire. So that's a starting point. A step towards serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead for the purpose of the fulfillment of these desires. Because I'm dependent upon him anyway. That's reality. And as just a pious person, but a devotee, I recognize that. That's what, and the first verse that we read, Kartam is saying, the Lord is very kind upon that person too. And part of the next increment up is recognize that by that effort, another happiness, and with that another desire, that is, to come to the stage where I'm free from this material desire. That rather than just like a platitude, something that really that awakens in the heart. I have this other desire. I wish to become free from it. But I'm, that's not where I am right now. But I wish to become free from it. Awakens through the shelter taking and the regulations of bhakti. And then the next step, and then the next step. And that, so rather than be upset with yourself or family members because there's a material desire, go step by step. Shelter, striving to take shelter for the fulfillment of that desire. And then, some desires are not so appropriate to be fulfilled, without mentioning. And then, so I just don't act on those, but I act on the ones that I know that are, to be, play music for Krishna or something, depending on the individual. Strive to, like this other person's case, strive to really become excellent in my career. Now, some persons may be for money. In his case, it's not so much for money. It's just a work ethic. He's a workaholic person that likes, and he recognizes that it's harmful at times, at least. He's acknowledging. So I don't want to, but it's in his blood. He can't just okay, I'm going to stop being a workaholic. He's a workaholic. So I know what to do. Connect that to for Krishna. So how can I use that in Krishna's service? There are ways that Krishna will give you the intelligence. How can you use that in Krishna's service? And it's going to be a little different for different people. But so just make that Krishna connection genuinely, sincerely, steadily. And then the material aspiration part subsides. and the light of transcendence becomes brighter. And it's not like there's a race. Okay, on your mark, get set. You know, and then we give a report, okay, so-and-so is way ahead of everybody, and this person is really lagging behind. It's not a race. Not a race. It's a way of life, living our life for Krishna. And it's fine that there's variety, or like we were speaking last night, diversity. That's beautiful. In a garden, different things grow in different times, different seasons for different things. It's fine. It's just how nature is. So if someone is going faster, someone's going slower, and somewhere in between, that's fine. That's just fine. But just make sure that the steps that are taken are progressive. You make a step and you don't go back. You make a step and you sustain it, and then you make another step. Do each of the things that you do in a quality way, like for Krishna, in the consciousness of this is for Krishna, and gradually, as I said, the spiritual light will become stronger, and that which is of the darkness side will be diminished by the spiritual light automatically. Like the lady that asked this morning about detachment and attachment. So first comes bhakti, developing a liking for Krishna and service to Krishna and devotional practices in relation to Krishna, and detachment will follow that. Exactly as Prabhupada did, he gave the Western people that were very confused young people in chanting, hearing, and prasadam. He didn't give, the do's and the don'ts initially. There's bhakti and his wonderful sublime association. So, same in with this situation. Put the cart before the horse. Put the horse before the cart, excuse me, and the horse will pull the cart. That horses are its association, and win the association of devotees, bhajana kriya, devotional activity. Little by little, and that's progress, little by little. Just make sure you're headed in the right direction, going towards Krishna. You'll get there. One of Prabhupada's phrases was, slow but steady wins the race. You know that phrase? The hare and the tortoise? Slow but steady wins the race. So no, it's not a race. But still, the slow but steady wins the race. What's needed is not just like a flash of exhibition of devotional fervor and then it fizzles like a shooting star. What happened to that person? Slow but steady wins the race. Okay? Yes?
As you mentioned about the essence of Bhagavatam, the purpose of life is not for sense gratification.
Yeah.
But it's striking, you mentioned that we hear it so repeatedly, we also say yes, but we still don't get it.
Oh, okay, that's the but. Okay.
So how do we
get it? I thought you were going to make an appeal for some exception or something. So how do we get it, is your question? Gradually, basically. By applying that which we do understand and being conscientious when we apply it. It's a little bit like the Mataji's question this morning about a detachment, where In order to become Krishna conscious, it can be instantaneous. Generally, it's gradual because we're attached to sense gratification, mental speculation. Therefore, it's gradual. So that means, on the one hand, becoming attached, becoming conscientiously absorbed in our devotional practices, thereby the other attachments slacken. The strength, the spiritual strength for detachment comes from the spiritual practices. Then comes the detachment from the rest. Viraktiranyatiracha. So the gradual process of regular hearing and chanting, Shravanam Kirtanam, Bhagavat Dharma, regularly engaging ourselves in Bhagavat Dharma, hearing Krishna Katha regularly, and then trying to apply it in a sincere way in our lives, and then the detachment from sense gratification, mental speculation follows gradually. Just as you were asking your question, I was thinking of during the Christmas weekend, we had a little gathering. So some of the students that attend the Washington University program in St. Louis, they had vacation. The international students couldn't go home. The ones that are like American, they could go home, but the ones that are international students, they couldn't go home. So they were invited to come. So we had a little, some time with them. And one of them was a Chinese student that's majoring in economics. And he's very thoughtful. And he said, I keep hearing you this word, detachment. Detachment. And he said, that really goes completely against consumer economics. Because consumer economics is attachment. Buy and consume. And I said, shh. You've understood. But, we may then consume, instead of for sense gratification, that which is for Krishna. I mean, we can spend lots for Krishna. But it's not, with the sense of attachment. It's with the sense that it's for Krishna. And if it's for Krishna, the best is for Krishna. Like that. Yeah, last question.
Siddharth Prabhu asked about the study and devotional service, and you said that we do everything for Krishna, but there is not a balance. So this is a Yavat question. So there is still a choice which I'm making.
Sure.
If I'm doing one thing.
Sure.
And then we hear that if something is not increasing our attachment for Krishna, then it's Shrameva Hi Kevalam. So if I'm putting some time in, say, career development, then I could have used that time in devotional service instead.
This is it's a false dilemma. If there is, we'll say it positively and negatively. Positively, if there is some purpose in serving Krishna, in developing your career, do it for Krishna. Negatively, if there's nothing in relation to career development that's in relation to Krishna, don't waste your time. So it's not balanced. So now we'll just do the bigger picture again. And I'll just use the phrase blocks of time. There's something that's important in our day or our week or the whatever unit you like to, schedule yourself, a month or a year, or some things that, during some time of the year I do more of this, And anyway, so you schedule things, blocks of time. Like, you know, I have like this reading break in my schedule. Because sometimes I don't have time as much as I would like, but I schedule it. And, you know, some time for association with devotees, some time for my studying of the scriptures, some time with my family, some time with my career, some time with taking a bath, and some time with, you know, there's time for all things, and you schedule time. And just like, then there's blocks of time. And when you're doing it, that this is the career time. And it does, if it's not in relation to Krishna, trash it. And if it's in relation to Krishna, do it in relation to Krishna. And it's not balance. It's just like something that I do. And then another block of time. And it's because it's all going to take me to Krishna. And if it's not going to take me to Krishna, it disappears. Okay. Thank you very much. Whoa, one from the ladies in the back. That's our challenge. That's our life in Krishna consciousness, is doing things for Krishna. And it's not, you know, your voice is not the only voice. You're expressing it, but we all know what that is. It's just doing mindlessly. You know, it's laziness or complacency, or it's the paucity of our Krishna consciousness, that we do the things that we're supposed to do mindlessly. And after some time, you know, then sometimes those mindlessly things disappear or diminish, or they're intermittent or something. We need to do those things, and we need to do them for Krishna. Engage in a prescribed duty and always think of me. Not just engage in your prescribed duty, mindlessly. And think of me. That's part of what we're enjoined to do. And once again, the most effective means for bringing that for Krishna component, the bhakti component, is chanting. Most important. Singular most important activity. May you all become good chanters. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.